you need to imagine how things could be different. You need to be able to say, all right, this looks like a stick, but look, suppose I used it like a, suppose I used it to get termites, or suppose I used it in this completely unprecedented way that I've never actually used anything before. And that kind of flexibility, and also an interesting thing that people sometimes call mental time travel, which is the idea that you could envision all these alternative routes through the future, which is something that we spend a lot of our time doing, and we kind of take it for granted that we spend a lot of our time doing it. But again, that seems to be something that's particularly human, that ability to imagine all these different ways, different routes we could take through the future. And it's connected to our ability to also think about the past. But I think actually tool use is clearly one thing that's important, but maybe even more important and more relevant to the kids pretending is our understanding of other people, our kind of psychological understanding. So one of the things that's distinctive about us is that we create our own societies, we create our own cultures. And an important ability is to say, from a psychological or social point of view, to say, okay, suppose I arranged the world differently, suppose I thought about the world differently, suppose I this is a person who's done, you know, who's got a different way of being in the world than I do, what would that be like? And then you can sort of think, okay, if I, one of the interesting things about human psychology and social life is that we create a lot of it ourselves. So, you know, people are always talking about imposter syndrome. Now the cure, so everybody, as far as I can tell, essentially every human being feels like they're an imposter. So they all feel like, I'm not actually doing, you know, I'm not actually a professor. I'm just sort of pretending to be a professor.
People think I am.
Yeah, exactly. Mostly, I'm not really a grown-up. I'm just pretending to be a grown-up. But of course, the cure is, yeah, well, everybody's just pretending to be a grown-up. And if you pretend to be a grown-up for long enough, then that's actually what being a grown-up consists of, or what being a professor consists of, doing a really, really good job of pretending to be a professor. And I think there's something profound about the way that we shape our own lives through thinking about what's possible, thinking about all the different ways that we could be. And we have many more degrees of freedom than other creatures do to do that, to shape who we are and shape what other things are. So I think when kids are just running around pretending, those are the kind of abilities that they're offering.
I certainly know, I mean, there's so many things that I want to touch on that you say, but one of the things I know in contemporary art is this idea of performing gender, and so there's a lot of discussion in queer circles and other circles about how we, you know, even things that are assigned to us biologically, we have ways of modifying, or through our own ability to imagine something different, or maybe our ability to accept something different, we can modify all these things. So the possibilities for things seem to never end.
Well, I think there's always these debates about nature and nurture and how much is there biologically and how much is the result of culture. But I think the thing that's, again, really striking about us human beings in particular is that culture is our nature. And that's kind of paradoxical, because we have to put so much time and energy into just, you know, taking care of these helpless babies for so long. And one idea is that protective period gives us a time when we can explore possibilities without actually having to do anything with them.
Right.
So even in, you know, like machine learning, people talk about this basic tension between explore and exploit learning. So exploit learning is, I want to figure out how to accomplish this particular end. I want to make this particular thing happen. I'm going to try and figure out how to do that. And explore learning is, who cares? I'm just going to try this out, see what happens. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. And you really need to have a balance of both of those. So exploit learning has the advantage that you're more likely to get to a kind of okay solution quickly, but it has the disadvantage that you might just get stuck. You know, there might be something that would be really good for you to do that's just far away from anything that you've done before. And if you're just noodling around in this little area, then you won't ever get there. Now, explore learning has the advantage that you might come on something that's really wild and crazy and very, very, very useful. But of course, all that time that you're sitting around, most of the things you think of are not going to be very useful. So somebody has to be, you know, if you're a crow dropping worms in your mouth, or if you're a baby feeding you during that time when you're actually doing that kind of exploration. And I think to a certain extent, what happens is that things like science and art are good examples of ways that we as adults, we put some kind of subset of adults in a way into the same position that children have, where they don't actually have to do anything that's absolutely useful or that's going to have outcomes. What they're for is exploring that space. So I think the idea of, you know, exploring possibilities, that's kind of fundamentally what both artists and scientists are doing. And it's because they have, you know, moms are sort of like the National Science Foundation and the National Endowment of the Arts from an evolutionary perspective, right? It's because, or you can think of it the other way around, the National Science Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts are really, should be good moms who just give their children some space to play and explore. And then it's not that, you know, it's not that, oh, okay, now and I can tell you what the benefits are going to be of that, right, of doing that, you know, our GNP is going to go up or math scores are going to go up or something like that. The whole point is that by not thinking in terms of what the benefits are going to be, you end up with benefits that are much greater than you would ever have thought before, and you end up in places that are really different from places that you thought.
Doesn't that suggest maybe a different set of criteria for valuing what's found, or
right,
for, you know, it seems that if you have a very narrow set of criteria for what's valuable, then most things might fall outside of that, including things like art, for instance. So it's kind of a loaded question.
Well, it's interesting because there really is this kind of paradox, which I think of as being the kind of paradox of playing. So, you know, one thing that happens is you tell people, oh yeah, there's all this evidence that play is really good for you and it lets you explore and lets you find out things. So then you get people saying to their children, okay, now play. I guess artists have this experience. Okay, be creative. Now I want you to do something that's not like, and scientists too. The funding agencies are always saying, okay, we want you to do something that's completely has never been done before,
right,
except we don't want to try anything that we think is going to fail at the same time.
Right.
So we want you to do something successful,
right,
that has never been done before. So the kind of paradox is, for it really to be play, you really can't be having in the back of your mind, oh yeah, and this is going to end up being work at the end of the day, right? It really, it really has to be, inspired by this kind of general exploratory motivation that is really different from the motivation to get rewarded or to become famous or to become rich or all the other things that we actually have as as motivations. And I think it's a real puzzle. Well, one of the things that's wonderful about being a developmental psychologist is you kind of just get that for free if you hang out with kids. But I think it's a real puzzle for adults about how they keep both of those things going. And of course, you know, as I always point out, I'm totally crazy about 2 and 3 and 4 year olds, but I would not want to live in a world that was run by 2 and 3 and 4 year olds, right? I mean, you know, they're beautiful and creative and brilliant, but they can't tie their shoes. And it is sometimes a little bit like, you know, living with a 2.5 year old is a little bit like living with certain kinds of artists who are extremely, certain kinds of scientists for that matter, who are brilliant and creative and can't take care of themselves, and you can never tell where they're going to be next. And, so you need both of those things, but it's, I think, part of our interesting challenge is to try and get, how do we balance both of those things? And another idea that I really love that's connected to this, that I think is also connected to a show like this, is the idea that when you think about searching through, say, a space of hypotheses or solutions for problems, you could have a lovely metaphor, which is just imagine that you're kind of in a box that's full of possibilities. And you're moving around in that box, and it's kind of like a molecule in a box full of air. And the idea is that there's 2 different kinds of ways that you can move through that space, and one of them is a kind of high-temperature search, and one of them is a low-temperature search. So a high-temperature search is like the little molecule when you heat it up, the air. It bounces around all over the place. It never stays in one place for very long. It, you know, kind of gets everywhere, but then it also is not very stable. So it's very flexible, but not very stable. And in a low-temperature search, if you think about it, is if you're the cold molecule, you're just staying there in that ice cube, right? You're doing the things you need to do in the ice cube, but you're not going very far away. And one of the ideas, in again, from machine learning, is a good way to get a really stable solution to a problem is start out by just doing this kind of wild exploration and then narrow in on a solution. And again, I think that is very similar to both the scientific and the artistic process a lot of the time, rather than thinking that you've actually got an outcome. And you can see that in, you know, all the many artistic traditions of doing variations and doing sketches and doing all these things that don't work before you actually, you know.
Some of the things you bring up about say funders or people in charge of your research, maybe telling you what to find and how to find your, what you mentioned about finding something new that no one's ever done before, but do it in a way that we can see is going to actually become valuable.
The
safety thing. I mean, I think that certainly hits a chord with a lot of artists that are going through advanced degree programs, where there's this sense of, you know, this clicking time clock, and that your time has to be valuable and it has to fit into certain sort of parameters. And so it's nice to know we have allies in the research as well.
I think a lot about residencies as like a really important thing for artists and anyone to take, and retreats in that way, where sometimes if you have like a set amount of time, it allows you to suspend some of those concerns, and often that is helped by being somewhere new, kind of, whether that's a new place where you say, okay, during these 2 months or a month, I'm allowing myself that kind of, you know, space. Mm-hmm. So that was definitely a motivation for this. To be able to say this is a building and a place that is, you know, there's elements of your work and your studio practice, but it's interacting amongst many people, and you kind of, by having it less precious just to your own world, you have to kind of open up a little bit and not be so sure what's going to happen. And,
this is your piece?
I curated the project, the exhibition.
And what do you think, Allison, you know, the idea of counterfactuals or the idea of possibilities is of course such a breath of air for hope and for horizons and expansion. And yet I think so much of us, as we get, you know, as we grow in our life, a lot of those possibilities seem to get more focused, or they close down, or certain areas. I was just talking to a friend of mine, another artist, and we were talking about this issue of applying for things and getting rejected, you know, and how do we keep our sites open, you know, in the face of that.
Well, there's a wonderful video that I love. So one of the other, you know, when you're talking about evolution and about other animals that have a relatively long, so across, we're sort of at the end of the distribution, but across lots of animals, you see this relationship between how long a period of immaturity there is and then how flexible and good at learning the adults are. Mm-hmm. And one of the really good examples of this are crows. So crows are like phenomenally intelligent birds. And there's this one set of crows off New Zealand called the New Caledonian crows, who are really intelligent. I mean, they're as good at using tools as chimps are, for example. They're very, very smart birds. And they have 2 years before the babies are actually able to feed by themselves, which is a really long time in the life of a bird. So one of the scientists actually did a video of, so okay, what's happening in those 2 years, right? Well, it turns out that these birds in the wild, the way they use their tool using, is that they actually create digging tools. I was thinking about it because it seems so much like something that you'd imagine in this exhibit. What they do is they take palm leaves and they strip off the leaves from the palms, and then they nibble on the end of them until they make sharp points, and then they hold them with their beaks at the wide end and then use the sharp end with the barbs that are left from all of the leaves that they stripped off, and they stick them into holes and they pull out termites. So they pull out insects. So the little barbs catch the insects and then they pull them out and then they eat them. And it's maybe not quite as complicated as making the indigo that we were just looking at, but it's pretty complicated. I mean, you know, it's a pretty complicated process. And when you watch the babies, the fledglings, essentially what they're doing for 2 years is screwing up. So for 2 years, they're taking it and putting the barbs on the top instead of on the bottom, and putting the wide end into the hole instead of the narrow end, and they're just failing. And it's, you know, kind of comical to watch them as they sort of try every possible variant on this scheme of how do you actually use the tools and not make it. And the mob crows are, and in fact in this case the dad crows as well, because often when there's this long immaturity, one of the consequences is you need a whole community to actually be able to keep the babies going. They're sort of, you know, tapping their feet and looking at these, you know, baby crows playing with their palm leaves, and then they just go and get the insects themselves and feed, you know. and they'll actually, you know, sort of drop the palm leaves for the babies to pick up. So they sort of, you know, give them a hand in the process. And if you look, I was just at a really interesting conference about this. Look, people looking at hunter-gatherer societies and foraging societies. And if you look in those societies, the kids, for instance, there's this great, terrifying film of a one-year-old, 12 months old, I mean, a baby, not two yet, and her father is showing her how to hit a yam with a knife so that you can pull out the stuff inside of it. And this little girl has the knife, and she has the yam, and she's poking away at it. And then her father kind of takes it and says, no, like this. And then she has a two-and-a-half-year-old brother, and the two-and-a-half-year-old is also involved in this process. And in that kind of circle of people, those possibilities for failure are there, but someone's watching to make sure that it won't happen. And then there's all these possibilities for innovation and creativity and finding out some new solution for, you know, even better way of getting the insects out of the trees. So I think part of it is it's the individuals who are out there doing this counterfactual work. But interestingly, especially for humans, we can't keep babies alive by ourselves. We need to have a community. And that community isn't just keeping the babies alive, it's also engaging in this kind of cultural process where, because there's lots of different cultural models around, then that's another way that the kids kind of have a sense of the scope of possibilities. Mm-hmm. So it's possibilities as they're thinking about them themselves, but also I think all the possibilities that are kind of manifested, you know, sort of think about being in an extended family where you have lots of uncles and aunts and older siblings and friends, and each one of them is sort of crazy in their own way, and each one of them does things a little differently, and each one of them gives you different advice about what you should do. That's kind of another way of extending that circle of possibilities. And again, I think an exhibit like this has some of that, you know, this is the crazy extended family. The crazy family Thanksgiving.
Yeah, we haven't had that full table Thanksgiving experience yet.
Next week, yeah. maybe that's our closing ceremony. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Sit at the table, getting our little
giant meal.
Yeah.
That sounds really good.
Yeah.
But by the way, I was thinking when we were out there looking at the indigo, that's such a dramatic example of, you know, those are skills that you see in non-industrialized, you know, communities where that whole elaborate set of knowledge and practice somehow had to get to generation to generation to generation. And then there had to be the possibility, there had to be that scope for variability. How much ash water do you put in? Should you put in more? Should you put in less? Should you try using this other plant? Right? And somehow that thing, which ends up with this incredibly skilled, elaborate process, had to develop over cultural periods of generations of people exploring that space of what are the things that you could do with, you know, water and plants and
plants. So would you say then that cultures, or, you know, anthropologically speaking, that human beings as a species also had a childhood, and if so, are we in a different phase now or not? What do you think?
Well, that's one of the things, again, that's striking about our nature being culture, is that and people often point this out, it's not as if there was a kind of natural way for us to behave and now we're in an unnatural way. Part of what makes us us is that we're really good at sort of, more or less, figuring out how to function in very different communities. And part of the way we work culturally is that there's this kind of constant, if we either had children always imitating what their parents do, or we had children always starting from scratch, we wouldn't have the kind of culture that we have as human beings. So somehow what happens is that children imitate enough of what their elders do so that they can get the cultural tradition and cultural information. But they also innovate enough, maybe sometimes just accidentally because they're playing around, to get something that now is the novel thing that's valuable to pass on to the next tradition. So I think that kind of, there's this kind of generational dance that we human beings are always engaged in, where, and maybe this is accelerated in our age, probably it has accelerated, but I think you can see it even, you know, look at the way that pot designs, you know, look at the way that archaeologists can track history by looking at things like, are the stripes vertical or are the stripes horizontal? Somebody had to say, you know what, let's just try horizontal stripes. And you can kind of imagine that the, you know, other guys were saying, oh, really, that's just completely impossible. That's just going to be a complete mess. These kids nowadays with their horizontal stripes, you know, they're just a sign that universe as the civilization as we know it is coming to a halt if they're doing the horizontal stripe thing. But that, I think that process is really pretty central to the way that we change and develop culturally.
No, I had a thought when you were saying that as animals, humans have a long immaturity.
Yeah.
And some people think that, like, our immaturity has been going longer.
Yeah.
And that would maybe kind of make sense with this thing is like, well, maybe we don't, you know, we have enough answers of how to just do things, you know, like we know how to grow enough food for everybody so that if we have a longer immaturity, it's like not necessarily this bad thing. It's like, oh, this more open, creative kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things that's interesting is that the kind of ecological, so what was the ecological trigger for having this long immaturity and this greater flexibility? And it's actually kind of interesting that biologists think that it was actually climate change. So my joke about this is it wasn't human-induced climate change, it was climate change-induced humans. So that what happened was that there was climate change, and the result was that the climate got to be much less predictable. So it wasn't that it got colder, it got warmer, it just got more variable around the time human beings were evolving. So what do you do when you're in a very variable, unpredictable environment? And having this kind of reliance on learning and on possibility is a good way of dealing with that kind of environment. And I think sort of the more we're in that kind of environment, the more we need a long, protective period of immaturity. And I think there, you know, I mean, after all, we have people in graduate school, right? Presumably, you know, people here are in graduate school. And that we, as we kind of have to deal with more variability and if we have to have more information, then we're extending the period before we're actually really competent, as opposed to like, which is, I think, partly why we're so shocked when we see the 12-month-old in the forager culture who's, you know, using a knife to chop things up and make stuff for dinner, because we're used to thinking of our children being kind of not competent in anything until they get their PhDs.
So in terms of a unpredictable environment, what do you think about, say, the development of religion or mythologies with cultures? And
yeah, I think that's a really interesting question about what was it. I mean, it's clear that one of the things that we do to try to make sense of the world around us is we tell stories. And I think that actually, you know, I'm not sure that theologians would like this, but I think there's an argument to be made that a lot of what we do with religion is we make up pretend sequences or we make up pretend stories that are important and significant and do actually tell us something about what's going on in the real world. And, you know, if you look at kids with stories, when they tell stories, they're not just random, right? They're actually designed to give you some information and to practice some information, especially about how people work and about how societies work. And I think a lot of mythologies and and religions you could think of as being that kind of pretend, those kind of pretend stories. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting that when you actually look at the history of literature, for example, the first, what you see early are really crazy, wild legends and myths, and you only get like realistic novels much later on in literary history. And there's something about being able, so I think you're telling a story. I mean, in a sense, that's what you do with any kind of counterfactual thinking, is you tell a story, you know it's false. It's important that you know it's false. You know it's not the same as if a prediction. So a prediction is, I have a true premise, I think this is the way the world is now, and because I know the way the world is now, I'm going to say this is how it's going to come out. That's what a prediction is like. A counterfactual, you say up front, this is not true, this is false, because this is not the way the world is. And so what I'm telling you now is how it's actually going to turn out. But the interesting thing is that exercise of, all right, this is false, but here's how it would go, here's how it would make sense, even if it's crazy false, you know, is a way of actually figuring out how the world works and then putting that to use to do other things. My 2.5-year-old grandson was visiting the other day, and he got in his grandpa's has a big chair, and there's a big joke about Augie, who's the 2-year-old, climbing into Pabu's big chair. So he very, you know, kind of mischievously climbed up and said, I'm in Pabu's chair. And and I said, oh, you better watch out, because that's the big chair, and then you might go in the medium-sized chair, and you might go in the little chair. If the little chair breaks, then the bears might come back. And he thought this was wonderful and started talking about this. And then about halfway through, we started playing all this game. He turned to me and said, you know, this is the story of Goldilocks. It was sort of like saying, okay, I know this is a counterfactual, it's about bears, it's about, you know, going off into the forest, it's about all sorts of things that Augie has never experienced, but he knew that this particular narrative, this particular story, with its, you know, morals and its important messages about
characters.
Of important characters was the Goldilocks story that he was sort of like, you know, this is like the Old Testament that we're talking about now. This is the Goldilocks story.
Well, I had a lip teacher who said something to the effect of, well, there's really only a couple dozen original stories and everything else is a variation.
That's right. And probably the, you transgress out of curiosity and then you have to retreat again is a pretty basic.
Right. So there's always that kind of causal relationship in religion, isn't that sort of the whole story of it, is do this and get that.
But I think when it works well, it's a way of trying to tell you something about you know, transgressing against the social group, or about being exploratory, or about guilt, or about treating other people well. It tells you something about those important social things in a way that's actually really important.
Sure. Do you see any things in our culture today that are operating in that way, that are giving us those kinds of stories, morality plays, or whatever you
narratives that
narratives,
you can
yeah.
you can yeah, I think that's it's a really interesting question about which of those things are really going to, which things are sort of off in their own world, and which are things that get adopted in a more general way, and how those things change as the culture's actually changing, and as children are changing. Although actually, like Goldilocks really works really well now, even though there's not little houses in the forest with, I guess people are still eating porridge, but a lot of that isn't there anymore, but it still works quite well as a basic story for 2-year-olds.
The Goldilocks zone is the habitable region. Extrasolar planets.
Is that right? Yeah, that's right. That's still a good story.
Well, one of my favorite versions of the Goldilocks story was done by an illustrator named Britton Turkle. Mm-hmm. And instead of Goldilocks going to the house, there's a family that lives in the woods, and the bear. And the bear comes to the house, and it's really lovely, and it's all illustrations. It's just really wonderful. Yeah.
Well, what we found in our empirical studies is that when we look at children's, we can look at children's engagement in pretend play, and we can also look at their counterfactual inference and something that isn't pretend at all, that's just really straightforward, like, you know, if I put this block on this machine, would it light up or not? And what we find is there's a quite strong correlation between how likely children are to engage in pretend it when we give them a pretend scenario, and how good they are at doing this kind of quite serious scientific-like counterfactuals about, well, and if I hadn't, you know, if this block wasn't obligate, what would happen if you put it onto the machine? And in some experiments that we're doing right now, for instance, what we do, let me see if I can illustrate this. This is all visual people. So we have a little box, and it has a switch, and it has two gears on it. And there's different ways that this box could work. It could be the switch is turning on and making this gear move, which makes this gear move, or maybe the switch is making both move, or maybe it's making this one move, which is making this one move. And your job as a kid is to figure out which one of those is the right story. So figure out how this little causal system works. And what we've been doing is we can ask them some questions about how this system works, either as pretend questions or as kind of counterfactual. So we can say, all right, now look, this is the way the machine works. The switch goes here, and then it hits this. It makes that gear go, which makes that gear go. Now, what if it worked differently? What if the switch made both of them go? And now, what if we took one of the gears off and we flipped the switch? What would happen to the other gear? So we're asking them to make predictions. And if we do that by saying, let's pretend that the gear works differently. So if we're pretending that it works with the switch making both of them go, then what should we pretend if we're taking the... Now we're going to pretend that we're taking the gear off. Now what are we pretending? And if you give that to the children first, they do that better, and they also do much better at understanding if you just ask them as a kind of scientific question about, all right, well, now what would happen if you took the gear off and you flipped the switch? So doing it as, let's pretend that the world is different, let's pretend that it works differently, actually works better than saying, what if, in a kind of more straightforward, hypothetical way with these 3 and 4 year old children. And again, I think that might be true for Congress as well.
Do you think that has to do with introducing a sort of element of play?
We're not sure. I mean, you know, is it something about the way you enact things when you pretend, or is it about it may be about the idea of pretending and playing kind of releases you from the pressure to actually think about it the way you would if it was real.
Without having to get it right.
Right. Maybe? Yeah.
Interesting. I have this idea that I'd like to hear what you think about it with how when I give myself space to think about the opposite of what's true, it sort of helps me think of things in a more dimensional way as opposed to just from the front side of how it looks, if it were to be right, say. And I haven't really thought about articulating that very well, but I... In my mind, it actually enriches the definition of what something is when I can see, when I can play around clearly with what it's not.
Mm-hmm. Well, in science, for instance, we talk about the difference between predictions. So straightforward. So I can predict something from something else without understanding it very well, right? So I could say, yeah, look, I'm going to predict that, you know, if people smoke more, then they'll get more cancer. Or I could predict that when I look up in the sky, and this is actually true, like Tycho Brahe was the great astronomer, just kept records of everything that he saw up in the sky. And he could predict if, you know, Venus is in this place, then Mars will be in that place. But you can do that. And we rely, and there's actually evidence from psychology that we rely a lot on those kinds of predictions. So I might not understand very much about why this is happening, but I can kind of make my way because I can predict it. But if I have a theory, if I actually have a model or a structure, I understand why something is happening, then not only can I predict what will happen if something else occurs, but I can make these counterfactuals. So I can think about all the possible different ways that it could be, and I can make what philosophers call interventions. I can say, yeah, and if I did this, if I made it different, then here's what would happen. And I think the opposite is true, too, that if you're thinking about building a theory, so you're thinking about understanding something in a kind of theoretical way, so think about, you know, Einstein getting to the theory of relativity. nothing is different. Well, there are things that are different, but nothing that you observe easily is different in relativistic physics and Newtonian physics. But his thinking, what would happen if you had, you know, a train that was going near the speed of light, actually led him to think more deeply about the way that the physics actually worked. And he probably couldn't have got there if he was thinking about, well, what would happen if you had a train that was going at 60 miles an hour? Because everybody knows what happens when a train goes at 60 miles an hour. But thinking about this complete counterfactual, trains can't go at the speed of light, made him think about the problem in a deeper way and made him think about it in a more theoretical way than he would have done otherwise, which I think is what you're describing as your own experience about thinking about the counterfactuals, thinking about the things that could not be true.
Yeah, and I certainly, in my own experience of in early childhood education, one of the richest pieces of working with children was being so near the ease of getting to that place so quickly. And that I found that very enriching for my own ability to then predict.
Well, there's some evidence that even if you look at the brains of babies and children as opposed to adults, you see some really striking differences that are kind of connected to this greater exploration. So in adults, for instance, if you pay attention to something, what happens is that you squirt a little bit of a chemical called acetylcholine on a part of your brain, and that makes that part of your brain much more plastic and flexible. But whenever you do that as an adult, you're also squirting out these inhibitory chemicals that make other parts of your brain stop being plastic, because it's sort of like, if it isn't broke, don't fix it. Just leave most of your brain alone. Don't mess with it. Just change the part that you need to change in order to accomplish the end that you want to accomplish. When you look at young animals, they're just bathed in these cholinergic transmitters. They've got tons of them all over the place. They don't yet have the inhibitory transmitters. And if you look at the way that their brains are structured, you see lots and lots of new neural connections being formed, and not as many of them being pruned. And then what happens is, as you get older, you keep the ones that work really well and you prune, you get rid of the ones that that don't. So one of the, and actually it turns out that if you look at cigarettes, for example, nicotine is actually mimicking the cholinergic chemicals. And coffee is actually inhibiting the inhibitors. It kind of releases some of the inhibitors. So if you kind of want to know what it's like to be a baby, it's like having, you know, 5 double espressos and a pack of Gauloises. And I think there's actually even a little bit of evidence that some psychedelic drugs have the effect of, their brain effects look like you kind of have a 11-month-old brain. So I think, you know, if you want a safe way, all of those are not safe ways of doing brain alterations if you're an adult. But if you hang out with babies, you can kind of get the effects of, the mind-expanding effects of all those chemicals, which are probably running around in the baby's brains without having any of the negative, side effects.
Yeah, sometimes working with 3 and 4 year olds in a classroom could really look like you're around some people on some strong drugs.
Yeah, exactly.
Too.
Strange
things.
But which is why they need you if you're, you know, a childcare worker or someone to be sitting there and taking care of them as they're off in these incredibly weird, strange places. But you get to. I always think that being a caregiver is, even though you don't get any money and you don't get any respect and you don't get any fame.
Go on.
There's that side. There's that kind of not so great side about it. But the good side about it is that you get to simultaneously be doing the most kind of adult, protective, caring, focused thing that you could ever do, and you get to be in there with the kids who are kind of on that. So in terms of the explore sort of spectrum, you're doing this incredibly difficult, fine-grained work of taking care of other people, and you're also off in the wild, crazy, mad universe of the 3-year-olds.
Can I ask you about just the title of your book,
mm-hmm.
The Philosophical Baby? You chose The Philosophical Baby, and I know that the subtitle there explains that without necessarily saying it outright, but can you say why you chose that specific title, mm-hmm. or did you have any other ideas for other titles or?
Well, it's actually a funny story because that was my title for the book in my own head all the time from the time I was writing it. And the reason is my position at Berkeley is in psychology, but then I have an affiliate position in philosophy as well. And I started out my career as a philosopher. I was a philosophy student until I was well into graduate school. And I feel as far as I'm concerned, I never really switched from doing that. That was what I wanted to do, and I wanted to answer these big philosophical questions, especially things about, look, we're in this world, and all that reaches us from the world is this little stream of photons at our retina and little disturbances of air at our ears, and yet we find out about a world that's full of people and objects and quarks and, you know, amazing stuff. How could we ever do that? And that's a really deep philosophical question. But I thought that if you looked at babies and children, as opposed to just asking the question, you could actually answer it, or maybe you could get something that was like an answer to it. And back in the 70s, which is when I was in graduate school, the philosopher, it is still true, I think, philosophers were not tuned into babies and children very much. That's been true for most of the 2000 years of philosophy. So what I see my whole career as, and not just my career, but I think the whole history of developmental psychology in the last 30 years has been to say, look, you have these big problems, big deep problems, like how do we understand other people's minds, how do we develop language, how do we get to know the world around us? And I think looking at babies is a really, really good way of answering that question. And then my editor about halfway through said, you know, this is going to scare people. They don't, you know, the word philosophical is too scary. You should change it to something else. And I tried a whole bunch of other things. And then finally, at the end, I said, you know what? I really like the philosophical baby the best. And we added the subtitle to make it a little more, which is what children's minds tell us about truth, love, and the meaning of life, to make it a little bit more approachable. But that was sort of the idea. Although it turns out, I thought, because I come from the East Coast, I'm not a native Californian, I thought the meaning of life, everyone would automatically think of as being in quotes, that you couldn't say the meaning of life without having little air quotes around it. But I think that's not true in California, where no one has any, you know, I did my dissertation work in England, and I always thought we should have a trade exchange where they sent us our irony, and then we sent them our sunshine, you know, so we kind of tend to be a little low on irony in California. So there are some people who complained to me that I did not actually tell them the meaning of life in the book. That was the sort of the false advertising to have the meaning of life in the title.
Well, I mean, those are, I think that we forget, some of us, I sometimes forget that those are actually the questions of philosophy, though.
Yeah.
On a fundamental level, that's what we're really looking
for. Yeah, that's
for.
What we're really doing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're certainly present in when you're, you know, when you're near a group of very young children. Yeah. I always found that very, very interesting on these basic levels. And you look around and just the same questions that I was dealing with in my own life were very similar in the lives of children.
And the children are sitting there and asking the questions to themselves, too. This is another great thing about being a developmental psychologist, that you can tell stories about your grandchildren all the time. But, I was talking to Augie, who again is just 2 in a bit, and I said, well, why are you Augie? He's very intent on the fact that he is Augie. He'll tell you that he's Augie. And after thinking a little bit, he said, I have Augie's face. Which is actually a pretty profound way of thinking about what your identity is that, you know, it's something about having Augie's face is the thing that actually makes you into Augie. And kids are thinking about all of those really deep things all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know that I've heard a similar anecdote in a Reggio Emilia based school where they gather lots of records of the children's speech as well as their interactions and as well as their physical products that they make. And that's one of the key things that the teachers pulled out was they were playing with masks, and one of the children said, no, that's so-and-so's face. That's a different person.
Yeah.
What does that, you know, what does that mean? What does that tell us about what they know and what they don't know? And I don't want to monopolize questions here, but what should we be doing as artists? That's going to be an awful question. No, I almost want to say, like, I sometimes feel that that artists could use some of the skills of researchers to better be able to articulate what it is they're working on or going through or finding or not finding. And I think sometimes we're in our own practices and processes and we don't take the time to maybe learn what some of those things are. Mm. But I think it could be helpful. I know that there's a lot of research-based art now, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting interaction. Sort of by definition, right? If you could translate something that was going on in, say, visual art into, you know, a bunch of propositions, then there would be no point in doing it as visual art. So there's obviously something about, there's some interesting analogies between the ways that we're doing the information that we present and the way that we present it and the way that people find out about it in the context of an artwork. It's really different from the way that it comes out just in terms of, say, a set mm-hmm. of propositions. But I do think that you could ask the question about why is it that sometimes those things work and sometimes those things don't work. So why is it a show like this is a nice example of the range of things that you can do, the range of activities and the range of phenomena that can be illuminating about, you know, about something, about what human life is like and why some of those work and why some of them seem to be informative and some of them don't seem to be informative. I think that's a big, interesting question that we could ask as researchers. And it's interesting, it's starting to happen, although I think maybe more with literature than with visual art, but there's some of it happening in visual art mm-hmm. too. And traditionally people like Gombrich, for example, you know, tried to talk about more classic visual art in those terms. So I think there's definitely work that can be done linking those two things. And it's interesting, when we started doing work about imagination and pretend play, we were just thinking about it as developmental psychologists. But just a month ago, we had a symposium at Stanford with a bunch of literary scholars, because of course they're really interested in pretending. That's one of the things that what they do, right? That's literary scholars, you know, people in the English department and in the French department who were studying how The Tale of Genji works or how an Arthur Miller play works. And of course what you're doing is very similar. And we had a fantastic symposium where half of the, really, really good, where half of the people were developmental psychologists, and we had some neuroscientists as well, and then the other half were people who are literary scholars and storytellers, trying to take both of our forms of expertise and combine them. And, you know, Art Shimomura and our department has tried to do some of that with visual arts. Mm-hmm. But I think it's an interesting challenge. Right.
If this show were, as opposed to it being artistic practices, if this were a show of scientific practices, what would it look like, do you think? What would be in place of the ceramic studio?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, you know, one of the things that I think is really true with kids and with universities, and this is something I feel quite strongly about, is that, again, if you think about, you know, that little girl in the forager culture, she's actually doing the things that are important in the culture from the time she's very young. And if you look at the way that we teach science, you don't actually get to do any of it until you're in graduate school, right? I mean, you're hearing about it, but you're not actually involved in it, engaged in it. And I'm not sure, you know, it might not look so different if you had a whole bunch of different labs. And it's not so different from the, you know, again, thinking about those Indigo Dyers, where you have start out not doing a very good job and you have to develop some skills and some practices. And I think if we had a more of a kind of an apprenticeship model of what's going on in science, that would be a much better way of training people to be scientists than the way that we do it now, where the apprenticeship only starts when you're, you know, 30, which seems a little late. One of the things that really strikes me with kids, for instance, and actually the visual arts are at an advantage here, actually, I think, is a kind of funny paradox, which is the very fact that things like art and music get dissed and don't get budgets and everything means that when kids are learning music and art, the way they're learning it is because they do it and then they have someone who's a master who says, nope, that's wrong, here's another way that you could get this skill. And if you watch the kids here, you want to learn how to do ceramics. You can't just sort of sit there and have someone talk to you about it. You actually have to do it, and you have to fail. It's just like the little crows figuring out how to use their tools. You have to do it and fail and try again and fail. And we actually do that with sports is the other place that we do that. We do it with sports, and we do it with music, and we do it with art. And kids love, you know, you can have some horrible tyrant of a ballet teacher or a sports coach, and the kids are perfectly happy to spend hours working out those skills. But we don't, you know, we don't actually have people who are writers teaching writing, and we don't have people who are scientists teaching science. And I think if we could have more of that kind of an apprenticeship model, which again, we're sort of seeing in a place like this, that would be a much better way of actually teaching science. So I've suggested, for instance, that we should scrap our undergraduate curriculum, and instead of having a bunch of lectures, you should sign up for 5 apprenticeships in a place like Berkeley, where most of the faculty are great researchers doing great original research or doing great original science. When you come in as an undergraduate, you should just have all of the researchers, all of the faculty should have a little website where we advertise, this is what I'm doing, and this is the kind of stuff that's going on, and here's what you could do in my lab. And then everyone would just sign up for a rotation of 5 different things. And they, you know, I guess the reason we don't do that is because they would probably be like the little crows. They would, you know, mess things up at first. But I think the advantage, when I was talking to this anthropologist who studies the kids in these forager cultures, one of the things she was saying is, you know, by the time they're 5 or 6, they have real skills. They're really contributing to the community. And she thinks part of the reason for that is, and even if you just look at things like how much housework they do, right? You know, they're much more likely to actually be doing housework, doing chores, than kids in our culture. And she thinks part of the reason for that is that when their kids are 1, they're starting to really want to imitate and really want to be involved in what the grown-ups are doing. They're not very good at it. It takes about 4 times as long to make pancakes with Augie as it does if I just make pancakes myself. But in those cultures, that's something everybody kind of tolerates and recognizes, that it's going to take longer because you have the kids doing it. As opposed to
foraging,
like hunter-gatherer kind of cultures. So the kids are doing things that are like the things that the adults are doing. You know, again, kind of like what we're seeing the kids doing here. And the adults are kind of willing to tolerate the fact that they're not going to start out doing them very well, but they're involving them, as opposed to sort of having, here's a place where I do my work, and here's a place where I send my children off to be at school. Kids don't get very much of a chance to actually see. So I've always thought, you know, sort of take your children to work day. That should be like take your children to work year, where you could actually give them some information about me.
Yeah. Well, it seems like, you know, we certainly have a better capacity to learn about the world if our relationships are solid with their primary caregiver, mother,
right,
fathers, and things. And so if those people are off earning their living somewhere else, out of the home.
I mean, you know, you can't go back, right?
Yeah.
So we're in a different universe than we were in then. But
yeah,
it is really striking when you look at the kids learning in these villages. Of course, what's happening is the work and the childcare are all in the same place and happening at the same time, even farming children. I mean, there was a really interesting monograph from the Society of Research and Child Development, and it was talking about, you know, we say, well, mothers have started working out of the home, but what they pointed out was that it's only maybe 50 years before mothers worked out of the home that fathers started working out of the home, because most people have been agriculturalists, most people have been farmers for most of human history, and even 100 years ago in the United States, most people, amazingly, something like 80% of people were farming in 1900. And if you're a farmer, then you learn and you do your work and you learn as a child, all those things are happening kind of simultaneously. And I do think kids are motivated and kind of designed to learn that way. Now, of course, we can't do that because we have lots of different skills, and the child of a developmental psychologist is not necessarily going to become a developmental psychologist, and the child of an artist is not necessarily going to become an artist, and someone is going to have to learn how to, you know, do whatever the 3D printing is that didn't exist at the time of their parents. But, so we can't completely do that, but I think we could have much more of that than we do. And museums are actually one of the places, both art museums and science museums, art museums, science museums, children's museums, are all institutions where that happens in our culture. And it's also, you know, there's a certain amount of ambivalence in my experience among museum people about, well, they all know that kids come to the museums and we should have kids programs, but there's sort of a bit of, I guess we have to have a children's program because everybody brings their kids and we'll get better funding if we do it. But I'm not sure that there's a sense that, you know, if we really could just do what we do without having to worry about the little children running around, it would be much better.
Science museums, that's not true. They're very eager to have kids programs.
Although even like the Exploratorium, which I've worked with, they don't quite know what to do with the 3s and 4-year-olds. So they're mm-hmm. and they're working to make sure that they can do something with them. But mm-hmm. they've said mm-hmm. that, you know, when it started out, there was a little bit of this, we are a science museum, we're not mm-hmm. a children's museum, we're a place for adults or for teenagers or for something to come to do science, not just a place where you take kids from. But I think that's probably not fair in general. I think most people recognize
that.
Yeah,
it certainly wasn't our experience when we took our kids there.
Yeah.
Great thing was kids were running around everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. And there were all sorts of cool things for them to look at, even if they weren't doing what the designers
were. You had to compete with the kids to play with the stuff.
Well, art museums, I mean, this museum that we're sitting in now, for me, was when my kids were growing up, even when they were little, was a great, you know, this kind of space. Well, you can see right behind us, right? I mean, this is a fantastic space, kind of play space for children to be.
Yeah, so I guess it's going to be, yeah. Well, gosh, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, coming thanks in. For inviting me, and thanks everyone for coming. That's great.
Yeah.
Coming to see our beautiful room.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to be ending the show soon.
And we're going to have some music coming, is that
right? Yeah, that's right, yeah. This is, today is going to conclude with a performance by a duo from Los Angeles who are visiting right now. And we are going to be recording it, which is part of the idea for today. Is, you know, you're enjoying these moments, but also the show is coming to a close in 1 week, so the kind of ephemera and the ways that we can kind of extend the ideas through recorded conversations and recorded music is a big reason to have this space active and used. So Bouquet will be performing in just a few moments, and this week will be our last here as this exhibition. The building is 6 months left or so of its existence. And,